The Takeaway is supported by Blue Apron. Blue Apron delivers farm-fresh, perfectly portioned ingredients and step-by-step recipes so you can make incredible meals at home. Visit blueapron.com/takeaway to get your first 3 meals free.
This is The Takeaway for Friday, December 16th, 2016.
This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. Thanks so much for listening. And we've been deliberately testing your patience and tolerance this week. I don't know if you're aware of it. But in each of 3 shows this week, we have aired longer conversations than normal about the city of Aleppo and the crisis in Syria. We have deliberately sought out voices who can testify directly as to their own frustration and anger and sadness regarding the lack of movement and progress in a war that has already claimed hundreds of thousands of lives and has trapped tens of thousands of civilians. Earlier this week, you may remember a UN refugee official pleaded on our air at length for people to listen. We let him speak, just as we let Basil Marshall, an expatriate refugee now in Germany, tell his long, passionate, convoluted story. We think that this may be the only way to really grasp the depth of what's happening now in Syria. The quick TV pictures day after day don't convey enough. As of this week, 4,742 refugees were reported dead or missing in 2016, making it the deadliest year on record for migrants crossing the Mediterranean, even when approximately 650,000 fewer people attempted the journey than in 2015. Imagine such a journey. What you are hearing is a dramatic rescue from the chilly waters of the Aegean Sea. Daphne Matsiaraki wanted to get past the random pictures she was seeing from Syria and Greece when she decided to use her Greek heritage as a way to gain access for her and her cameras to the rescue boats of the Greek Coast Guard around the island of Lesbos, which is a landing spot for refugees from Syria and all over the Middle East. Matsiaraki was born and raised in Athens, but has most recently been living in the United States. Her short film, 4.1 Miles, follows Coast Guard Captain Kyriakos Papadopoulos through the heart of the crisis, attempting to save thousands of lives crossing that 4.1-mile stretch between the island of Lesbos and Turkey.
The Coast Guard captains were, in every kind of way, in the epicenter of this. They are the point where two worlds meet, and they meet under such severe circumstances. I found out that this Coast Guard captain and all the 4 Coast Guard captains that are on the island have no training to respond to this kind of emergency. Their previous life was very peaceful and easy, and their job was just routine border patrol in the peaceful waters of Greece. And suddenly, they found themselves caught in this huge crisis, in the biggest refugee crisis since World War II. They were completely unprepared, not trained, without any equipment. My main character, Kyriakos Papadopoulos, a captain of one of the 4 small Coast Guard boats, has no CPR training. His boat is very small and doesn't have the necessary equipment to respond to something like that. They don't even have thermal cameras. But in this vast emergency, he has no other option but to respond.
What did the emergency bring out of Kyriakos? It makes him larger than life in your film.
Yeah, exactly. Kyriakos is suddenly caught in the middle of between life and death. He becomes suddenly this modern day hero with no exaggeration. I have never seen somebody who gives their life and their soul in every moment, every day, because he feels this responsibility. And I find it quite rare in a way, because we don't necessarily respond as citizens and as human beings to the needs of our fellow human beings in our society. And I felt that Kyriakos was emblematic of the opposite. He responded, and he still is responding, in the most brave and heroic way that a person can.
When did you know that you were at that point in the crisis where you were seeing the details and seeing the faces of the people, and they weren't other people. They were human beings just like you. When did you feel that you were right up into the face of the crisis?
Well, the point where I felt I was really in the middle of this was when I went on the Coast Guard boat. I really didn't know what to expect. Kyriakos got a call that there was an incident, one of these small dinghy boats, the motor had stopped in the middle of the sea, like many of them do all the time. So we had to go and find this dinghy boat. And on the way there, it was so stressful. And you can see it in the film. They don't even know where they're going. They're looking in the sea. And then suddenly, we see a boat, a tiny little inflatable boat, where it's meant to hold 5-6 people, packed with 80 people, 100 people, something like that, packed with small kids and mothers, and everyone being so scared. And whilst the crew was trying to get these people up, a mother with two small boys fell in the water. And the cold waters of the Aegean Sea, the waves were big, it was the middle of the winter, the water is very cold. And these people have never seen the sea before. They don't know how to swim, most likely. And I saw the fear in their eyes. I've never seen people so scared in my life. And it wasn't just because they were scared because of the journey. It felt like they were traumatized, deeply traumatized, because these people were coming from war. I've never felt so close to war, and I've never seen kids so scared in my life. And that was very, very scary. And that made me feel so helpless and so small. And when I realized that this was not just one boat, but this was happening every minute, it was people coming in masses, scared people coming, and they were risking everything. And these people, after talking to so many of them, they felt that they were going to die one way or another. So it was just, for me, unreal to see people in that stage, in the waters of my peaceful country.
Daphne, what happened to the woman who fell in the water with the two boys?
The crew had to put everyone else first as safely as they could up on the Coast Guard boat. The Coast Guard boat is tiny, pulling literally people with their hands. They have no equipment, and you can see it. And then go to the woman with the two small children. The woman was fine. The two small children were brought on board unconscious, and it took 10 to 15 minutes to go to the dock. And there was only at that point there were only two ambulances on the island, and the main hospital of the island is an hour and a half away from that small port, that small village that you see in the film. So we waited for about 45 minutes for the ambulances to come, or an hour. And in the meanwhile, Kyriakos and the rest of the crew were trying to give CPR to these kids without even knowing how to do CPR. They've learned, I guess, in the process. The girl regained consciousness as we were waiting for the ambulance. The boy was unconscious. Kyriakos put him in the ambulance. A few hours after that, we learned that the boy was still alive, but unfortunately, he passed away 2 days after that in the ER. And that's who I've dedicated this film to, that young little boy. He was 7 years old. And, of course, the rest of the kids that have lost their lives in this tragic journey.
How did you keep hold of the camera during all of this?
It was very hard. I had to keep reminding myself all the time that I was on this boat because I had to tell this story the way it is. I owed it to the people to all these refugees and migrants to tell this story in the most fair way possible and to give them justice. They wouldn't give access to any filmmaker or any journalist on the Coast Guard boat. So in a way, I had a huge privilege of being there. So that gave me a lot of strength.
Is there a picture, a face that you didn't capture that you can still remember?
Yeah, for sure. There were all these small children that I remember. They're not in the film. I remember one time I was done shooting. It was night and I was going back at my nice hotel, and which was right on the beach. And at this moment, we saw a small dinghy boat in the middle of the night coming out safely. However, it was coming out in the middle of the night from a journey that was taking them 5 hours to cross from Turkey to Greece. Normally, with a speedboat, it would be 10 minutes or 20 minutes. And I remember a mother coming out of this boat with a tiny, small baby, must have been 2 months old, which was soaking wet and freezing. It was, the baby was frozen. And they just came out and we were just unloading the gear from the car. And I said, okay, just come in the car. And I didn't know where to take these people. There was nowhere to take these people. And so I took them to a cafe nearby and I bought them tea and I helped her, I helped the mother undress the baby and gave them some of my clothes because I didn't have any other clothes. And I still felt so helpless because that was just one mother with one child that I helped. There were thousands of people that needed help. Tens and hundreds of thousands of people. And I knew that there were more people that they were trying to escape war, that they were in the beginning of their journey, and that they had this ahead of them without knowing what they had to face.
What did this teach you about what it must be like to face war in your own home?
It's history repeated in a lot of ways. The island of Lesbos has historically been welcoming refugees. Jewish people did the same route. Greek people fled the western shores of Turkey in 1922 and went to Lesbos in the same ways. The father of Kyriakos actually is a refugee himself from 1922, from Smyrna. And I asked him, how do you feel seeing all these people coming to your island? And he said to me, I see myself. There isn't any worse feeling than being a refugee, than having to flee your home, having to leave everything behind and come with nothing to a different country where you don't have anything, and people often treat you as second class or third class citizen. So for me, this film, of course, was about the refugee crisis in Europe and these people, but it was really about the responsibility that we all have as members of this society, our responsiveness. And I would say that we really need to rethink the choices that we make and how we act and how we treat our fellow human beings, because maybe it wouldn't happen to us in the same way. I don't think that people in Syria thought that it would happen to them either.
Well, Dafti, it's been great speaking with you.
Likewise. Thank you so much for having me.
Dafni Matsiaraki is the director and producer of 4.1 Miles. The film is part of the Emmy-winning New York Times Op Doc series of short documentaries. Within the constituency who elected and support President-elect Donald Trump, there are suddenly divisions over the issue of alleged Russian interference, even Vladimir Putin directed interference in the presidential election. GOP Senators John McCain and Lindsey Graham are calling for an investigation into the depth of Russia's cyber attacks during the campaign. President Obama is calling for retaliation. President-elect Trump is tweeting. Are we talking about the same cyber attacks where it was revealed that the head of the DNC illegally gave Hillary the questions to the debate? This on top of a tweet earlier this week where he said, "These are the same people that said Saddam Hussein had weapons of mass destruction." To get the conservative takeaway on this news soft on Russia accusation, Washington correspondent Todd Zwillick spoke with Chris Deaton, online editor at the Weekly Standard.
Chris, have you been one of the conservatives who've been dismayed by this recent Republican warming to Donald Trump? You do see among people who are sort of on the Trump train a new attitude here.
Yeah, and it's bizarre. That's the word that I would have to use it just because it was so abrupt. I understand the idea of wanting to have more friendly diplomatic relations with any country, really, from an economic standpoint. And when you do have the entire intelligence community reaching this conclusion, and you do see the adversarial relationship that's been going on behind closed doors, then you have to have a better reason to ratchet down pressure as opposed to this abrupt shift in policy that we kind of see. You just have to wonder, where does it come from? Is this a matter of trying something new? Is this, you know, the Obama administration opening itself up to Cuba, for example, and just saying that it's simply time to change our stance toward this nation? There really hasn't been much of an idea or a genesis for this outside of the fact that indeed Donald Trump just brings a different perspective on this to the table. And now that Donald Trump is at the head of all of this, it is simply time to change our approach.
You know, at the same time, in the immediate sense, there's also, you know, you have President Obama telling NPR that the United States will respond at a time of our choosing. And Donald Trump reported in the New York Times, you and I are having this conversation about foreign policy. He says in the New York Times, the CIA is out to get me, and there's people there who want to delegitimize my presidency.
Really, I think what we're seeing here is just simply Josh Earnest put it this way the other day, and far be it for me to agree with Josh Earnest, but I think when he said the other day during the press briefing that, look, you have to remember the intelligence community comprises these 17 independent agencies, and when they are reaching these sorts of conclusions wholesale and being relatively unambiguous about using the term, quote, senior most officials being responsible for this election hacking activity, or at least those officials needing to pull the strings somehow. It can only happen with their enabling. You have to agree that that's some pretty unambiguous wording here. And for there to be rank corruption across every single apparatus inside of that intelligence community would be a pretty extraordinary finding indeed.
So, Chris Deaton, let's talk about Rex Tillerson, the Exxon CEO who's the nominee to be Secretary of State. I know a lot of conservatives like Tillerson. They like his business background. He's been kind of an ersatz diplomat because he runs this gigantic corporation making deals all over the world. But it seems like this Russia hacking intelligence conversation that you and I are having is about to come down on the Tillerson nomination, and he might serve as a proxy to senators who want to brush Donald Trump back on the whole issue of Russia in our election.
It's going to be very interesting to see, because that's going to be one of the more contentious confirmation hearings that I think we're going to see. And obviously, this is right around the corner. I mean, we have to remember that inauguration is just a few weeks off here, and this process is going to be getting kicked off in earnest. One of the things that we have to keep an eye out for, I think, is exactly the way that the Senate approaches what Tillerson has done with his past that is outside the confines of his strict energy background. I mean, there have been some words spoken about the fact that, well, Tillerson's this big oil executive, but on the other hand, he said some interesting things about, you know, climate change in the past, and where does he truly fall down on that? All of that, I think, is going to be immaterial to what it is that you just brought up. It is the Russia connections. It is his business dealings. And at that point, when Donald Trump is said to look at Rex Tillerson as his kind of guy, it's a vintage Donald Trump pick with the business background and his approach to making connections worldwide and making sure that people are shaking hands and not wanting to be adversarial with such a typical adversary like Russia. It's like you said, yes, Rex Tillerson can kind of be a proxy for Trump at that point.
Chris Deaton, let's solve health care before I let you go right now. Let's solve Obamacare. It's going to be repealed early in the Congress. Now, Republicans have been yelling about their health care plans for 20 years and have never really been under pressure to do anything about them. We all know that. Now that they're going to repeal Obamacare, they're setting themselves up with a deadline. Republicans have no choice but to produce, and to produce in a way that doesn't leave 20 million people without health insurance. They're going to be able to do it?
The bridge is going to be what's sloppy. The lack of ideas, that is something that is simply just not true. Now, it's fair to say that if you want to critique the ideas, that's just fine. But, you know, Paul Ryan did come out with his earlier this year, and Orrin Hatch and Richard Burr and Tom Coburn did have their own the year before. And they are fully fleshed out ideas with respect to what a more Republican agenda would look like for healthcare policy. But the bridge, I think, is going to continue to be the problem. I mean, how do you actually time this just from a logistical standpoint to make sure that people don't drop off of health insurance rolls, to make sure that they're not hit with this in the face right up front, that those consumers, those 10 million consumers, are able to make a smooth transition over to a new system? I think that's going to be one of the key details that has to be where it's not a detail. It's actually massive. It's one of the massive aspects of this entire process. It's going to have to be worked out to ensure that the political nightmarishness of this, and it will get to that point, does become mitigated, because it's just such a difficult issue to legislate and to own. And I think we've seen that. It's been obvious over the course of almost a decade now.
Russian meddling in a U.S. election, a nightmare to some. Healthcare reform, a nightmare to others. Chris Deaton, online editor for the Weekly Standard. Thanks, Chris.
Thanks much.
This segment's for everybody, but especially for those of you who may have been having the same conversation over and over again lately about Trump this or America in trouble that. And maybe you've been using the word dysfunction more than you used to use the word awesome. Huh? Does that sound familiar? I've got something for you. Bob Graham is someone I've known for a long time. He's been Florida's senator and governor. He's a skilled Washington, D.C. insider when he wants to be, and an eloquent advocate and activist, an outsider when he needs to be. He admits that the 2016 election took him by surprise, but in the weeks since, he believes the disaffection and alienation people have expressed toward Washington, feelings that got Donald Trump elected, offer a lesson for an aging democracy. Forget the federal government, Graham says. It's time to go local. The former chairman of the Senate Intelligence Committee, founder of the Bob Graham Center for Public Service, is author of America, the Owner's Manual, You Can Fight City Hall and Win. Graham wants you to know that the next important political movement could be hatched at your kitchen table.
One that's well known is Mothers Against Drunk Driving. That organization started in a living room in Sacramento, California, of mothers, some of whom had children who'd been killed by a drunk driver. They were grieving, but they decided they wanted to do more than grieve. They wanted to try to solve or at least mitigate the problem. So they had as one of their first objectives to move the age of drinking from 18 to 21. They then had the question of how do you do that? They did it quickly in their home state of California, but they realized how difficult it was going to be to get the other 49 states to participate. So they went to Washington, where there was a former Californian named Ronald Reagan as president, and they convinced him to use the power of control over federal highway funds to condition those dollars based on a state's changing its drinking age. And with that tactic, in a period of less than 5 years, they were able to get all 50 states at the 21-year-old drinking age. And now, over some 30 years, they've cut the number of deaths attributable to drunk driving in the United States almost in half.
Even with that high-minded notion of what can be possibly accomplished at the local level, don't you think Americans are kind of joining the rest of the world? You travel a lot. I travel a lot. People around the world in most places think of their government in extraordinarily cynical terms. It seems like America is coming to this, like the rest of the world is coming to this. And Donald Trump is an oligarch. And most Americans look at the Putin thing and say, oh, it's just like Russia. It's just like, you know, we don't care.
John, I think what you've just said underscores the even greater importance of what we're doing. there's a group now which has come up with a complex data-driven system of evaluating when a democracy is moving towards authoritarianism. And it is distressing the number of countries that are on that list. For instance, recently Poland has gone from being the star of the emerging former communist Cold War states to being a democracy. Unfortunately, it now is in reverse and going back towards more authoritarianism. Turkey is another current example. And the United States is showing increasing steps towards the acceptance of a strong leader over a of, by, and for the people government. I think we need to act now, or 10 or 20 or 30 years from now, we could wake up with a much different America than the people who joined Alexander Hamilton thought they were creating.
What do you think this election represents? A complete breakdown of the democratic system in the United States? It seems to me 27% of the people can't elect a president and expect to have a mandate to move forward with the rest of the country.
John, I think there are a lot of lessons to be learned from this election. One of them is the depth of people's sense of alienation from their government. My answer to the question of what do we do about this is to say, let's give people the skills that they will require to be actively involved so that they don't feel as if the thing I'm concerned with can only be dealt with if the candidate that I favor is elected. You as a citizen, with your rights and responsibilities in this democracy, can make a difference without having to rely on unelected politicians.
Much of the world has suggested that U.S. policy in the Middle East is governed by oil. Having Tillerson as Secretary of State, for their perspective, would say, yeah, okay, this is honest now. This is the way it is. This is the way it's always been. How do you respond to that?
I think oil has driven much of our feelings in not only U.S.-Russian relations, but relations in the Middle East. You may know I've been a longtime advocate for releasing all the information from 9/11 about the Saudi role in 9/11, which I think is that 9/11 would not have occurred but for the facilitation that the Saudis provided, and the American people have thus far been denied the information to assess whether Michael.
And not only that, the U.S. government is assisting the Saudis in the war in Yemen.
In Yemen.
Which is causing a famine.
And thousands of people, innocent civilians, have been killed. So I think that, again, it's the bright light of sunshine, letting the American people know what their government is doing in relation to Russia, to Saudi Arabia, or any other country, which is the best palliative to excessive influence by a foreign government over U.S. policy.
You've always been energetic and dogged in all of your issues that you speak passionately about, and as an advocate for American democracy, the same. Yet, in light of what's happened, are you fearful?
I wouldn't use the word fearful. I would use the word I'm very concerned at the erosion that I see in the willingness of Americans to be actively involved in their democracy. From the days of de Tocqueville, who wrote about that the distinguishing characteristic of America was the engagement of its people. That's been part of the American dream. And I'm worried that if more and more people become distrustful, suspicious, and antagonistic towards government, that creates the environment in which a strong person like those who emerged in Europe in the 1920s and 30s out of a somewhat similar period of estrangement from government could happen in the United States.
And such a person would be the president of that 46% of Americans who didn't vote?
That could be. I hope that Mr. Trump does not have those kinds of aspirations or views of what American democracy is about, but he's going to be he is being tested now in this transition period, and even more so after January the 20th.
Senator Graham, thank you so much.
Thank you very much, John.
The Takeaway is supported by Blue Apron. Blue Apron partners with sustainable farms, fisheries, and ranchers to bring you all the ingredients you need to create incredible home-cooked meals. Ingredients come paired with an easy-to-follow recipe card, delivered to your door weekly in a refrigerated box. Rediscover how fun cooking can be while enjoying specialty ingredients and exploring new flavors and cuisines. Get your first three Blue Apron meals free plus free shipping by visiting blueapron.com/takeaway.
From the real estate visionaries who brought surfing and 30 million visitors a year to the middle of Alberta, Canada, and carved the Mall of America out of the cheerless suburbs of Minneapolis to make a landmark as unmistakable as Mount Rushmore, comes a challenge that may outdo everything that's come before. In the swamps of New Jersey, a troubled 13-year cash sinkhole, once called Xanadu, is rising again. Construction has begun on the newly dubbed American Dream Shopping Mall in East Rutherford, New Jersey. WNYC producer Ilya Marit says the viability of this, the only suburban shopping mall currently under construction in America, could say a lot about the future of brick-and-mortar retail in an increasingly online world.
If it gets built, then it's a developer getting over one of the most monumental humps. This has been in the works since 2003. We're on the third developer, the fourth governor, and there's a lot of questions about whether private lenders really believe in a project like this. So if it does get built, it means maybe brick and mortar does have some kind of future. And if it doesn't get built, boy, I mean, it could be in the first graph of the obituary for the shopping mall.
What do people say around there?
A lot of people in New Jersey specifically are just really, really skeptical of the project. I talked to this guy, Matt Regan. This was actually late summer. I met him in the parking lot of MetLife Stadium, which is just across the New Jersey Turnpike.
Where the Giants play.
That's right, and the Jets.
And the
he was grilling burgers before a Springsteen concert. And so I asked him about what he thinks about this behemoth right across the highway. Here's what he said.
They're going to f*** it up again. It's never going to open.
Why do you say?
Because they've already had more than enough money to build what they wanted to build, and they haven't done it yet. As long as I can remember, they've been working on this thing, and it's just not going to happen. It makes me angry every time I drive by.
And that's a totally common attitude in New Jersey.
And not just New Jersey. I mean, the idea that brick and mortar has a future is, you know, disputed by the fact that there's so much online shopping, and the online experience seems to have supplanted so much of the shopping in person.
Yeah, this is the first year, according to the National Federation of Retailers, that online shopping post-Thanksgiving just edged ahead of brick and mortar, like in-store shopping. So that's a huge milestone. But this really surprised me in my reporting. People who study shopping malls do not believe that e-commerce has been the greatest problem for shopping malls until this point. No, the greatest problem was overbuilding in the 90s when Wall Street believed that square feet equaled market share, which it kind of did up until a point. But then we went way beyond that. So today there's 48 square feet of retail for every American. The peak a few years ago around 2010 was 50 square feet. And they say we have a long way to drop to get in line with other advanced industrial countries, to get in line with what we ought to have.
And what is it about the brick-and-mortar experience that can't be duplicated online that might be construed as an advantage for the shopping mall?
Well, you just look at like what retailers continue to exist and which don't. So it's very uneven across the sectors. And that should give retailers, I think, some hope that if they can come up with some doodads, some entertainment, they can get people to the store and make it a good experience. But it has to be a good experience.
This Thanksgiving, I went to Minnesota where my parents are, and we went to the Mall of America on Black Friday.
Uh-huh.
And I was amazed at how they had done some things that made it work, that made it a distinctive experience, and that was really important.
So I went there for 3 days right after Election Day, and I wanted to go there because it's the same owner who owns Mall of America.
Really?
Is the developer of this mall in the New Jersey Meadowlands. So I wanted to know, what does their work look like? And I'm a New York City kid, so I don't really know malls. And I was astonished I mean, I was there midweek, but I was astonished to find that I liked it there.
Yeah.
There's a lot of natural light. You can always orient yourself. Even though it's huge, you sort of know where you are.
And there was a, you know, there's this great public transit system that they've just put in there.
Fantastic.
Which for city people like us,
yeah.
You know, we love that.
Yeah.
So, you know, maybe there is hope.
I think, you know, the argument for the people who are for this is that if anybody can do it, it's these guys, because they figured out the 555 family, the Gurmezian family, they figured out how to combine entertainment with retail. The question, though, remains, does America really want this kind
right.
of destination?
Gurmezian, that's the family?
The Gurmezian family emigrated from Iran to Canada in the 1950s. They developed the largest shopping mall on the continent, West Edmonton Mall, in the early 80s.
They're the Edmonton people.
Yeah. But here's the crazy thing about the Gurmezians. They haven't built anything big since Mall of America. That was 1992. So they have a vision, but they haven't convinced anybody to go for this vision until New Jersey. And that's the hump that they need to get over now. They need to raise the financing, raise the final $2.7 billion. That'll make this an almost $5 billion shopping mall. That's
wow.
what they need to do.
Ilya Marritz is a reporter for WNYC. Thanks so much.
You're very welcome.
This is The Takeaway. I'm John Huckenberry. In my house, there's a rule. Any holiday movies or music are banned until after Thanksgiving. It seems like a reasonable enough rule, except that it makes my kids kind of desperate. And in my house, my kids are playing the Will Ferrell movie Elf. Over and over. It's sad, really. I mean, how many times do I have to hear about those four important food groups?
Candy, candy canes, candy corns, and syrup.
Melissa Locker, culture reporter for Time, The Guardian, and The Takeaway, it seems, has the same problem. Her son is stuck on the comedy Home Alone.
I don't think so.
So Melissa has come up with a list of holiday films that suit any taste or era, starting with the 1940s, The Little Shop Around the Corner.
Younger viewers may recognize You've Got Mail, which is based on the same premise, but the original is Ernst Lubitsch, and it's kind of the quintessential holiday meet-cute where two rival shopkeepers are battling it out, and they really, really hate each other.
Imagine you dictating what I should wear.
Well, for heaven's sake, I don't care what you wear. If you want to look like a pony in the circus, it's all right. But I have troubles of my own without your blouse coming between Mr. Monacek and me.
Listen, I sold as much goods yesterday as anybody else in the shop. 95 Tango 50 isn't bad for a rainy Monday 3 weeks before Christmas. Did you tell that to Mr. Monacek?
Yes, I did.
And what did he say?
He said, tell him not to come in that blouse anymore.
Tell him I won't.
I will.
One thing that they don't know is that they've actually been having a secret correspondence this whole time and have kind of fallen in love with each other.
Well, staying with that period, Miracle on 34th Street is your all-time greatest hit.
I rewatched it recently, and it's not nearly as kind of cloying and sentimental as you think. These people are pretty harsh.
And it's got a sort of a feminist track in there of like, have your own career. Don't be defined by your man.
Yeah, and it's also a, you know, kind of a single mother who really wants to infuse her daughter with a sense of, you know, strength and self-reliance. She wants her to, you know, base her beliefs on facts, not kind of these stereotypes or beliefs.
Would you please tell her that you're not really Santa Claus? That there actually is no such person?
Well, I'm sorry to disagree with you, Mrs. Walker, but not only is there such a person, but here I am to prove it.
What's your name?
Chris Kringle.
I mean your real name.
That is my real name.
Trading Places takes us away from the traditional Christmas crash, but what do you think?
It is one of the ultimate screwball comedies. This one's not really for kids, but for older children it could definitely work, or teenagers. It's, you know, completely hilarious. It involves Dan Aykroyd as a kind of stuffy banker type, and Eddie Murphy as a street hustler, and these two kind of rich white dudes come in and try and make them switch places on a dare.
Duke's using us as guinea pigs. See how our lives would turn out. They made a bet.
Fred is true, sir.
I believe him, Louie.
Duke's ruined my life over a bet. For how much?
A dollar.
Muppet Christmas Carol. Now, I haven't seen this. Is this from the sort of golden era of the Muppets?
This was the first Muppet movie that they made after Jim Henson passed away, and so it was kind of bittersweet for a lot of people. But I have to say, out of the many, many versions of A Christmas Carol, which has gotten a lot of different takes on Charles Dickens' story, the Muppet Christmas Carol kind of works. Plus, it stars Michael Caine, and he is incredible as Scrooge.
If you please, Mr. Scrooge, it's gotten colder.
Yeah.
Any bookkeeping staff would like to have an extra shovel full of coal for the fire?
We can't do the bookkeeping.
Yeah, all of our pens have turned to inksicles. Yeah, our assets are frozen.
How would the bookkeepers like to be suddenly
unemployed?
Heat wave!
This is my island in the sun.
Oh, That's fantastic. Finally, I have to say, you've really brought me back here. Santa Claus Conquers the Martians. I know this movie.
This is not a good movie. It is a patently ridiculous story about Martians coming to Earth and kidnapping Santa Claus. They want to make Santa Claus bring Christmas cheer to the Martians. And it doesn't go exactly as they plan.
Is Elon Musk in this movie?
Yeah, I think Elon Musk would be a great addition to this movie, but it does have Pia Zadora, who's pretty much the same thing.
Pia Zadora, oh my God.
Right. So, and I mean, Pia Zadora and Elon Musk are more or less interchangeable.
There you go. Melissa Locker, culture reporter for Time, The Guardian, and The Takeaway, and you can find a link to Melissa's piece for Elle Magazine on our website, thetakeaway.org. Merry Christmas.
Merry Christmas.
I am your father.
Houston, we have a problem.
I'm from Iowa. I only work in outer space.
I'm having trouble with the radar, sir.
What's wrong with it?
I've lost the bleeps, I've lost the sweeps, and I've lost the creeps.
I'm sorry, Dave. I'm afraid I can't do that.
Some sci-fi references there as we speak to Rafer Guzman, who's the film critic for Newsday, who's right here in the studio. Hey there, Rafer.
Hey, John.
It's great to talk to you. I want you to know that as we're about to talk about blockbuster after blockbuster in this holiday season, that I have come from, in the wee hours of the morning, a screening of Rogue One.
Aha, you're an early Rogue One viewer.
I was an early Rogue One viewer. In Times Square, there were six other people in the theater, and we were the only ones who were not wearing weird suits. It was not a sellout. It was not a sellout.
Oh, interesting. Okay.
What did you think of this? My son was absolutely over the moon for this, and it was a great experience for us. What did you think?
You know, well, this is the first standalone film in the new franchise. Felicity Jones plays Jyn Erso. She's this loner who joins the Resistance. They're going to steal the plans to the Death Star. This is basically the run-up to everything that happened in the very first Star Wars film, A New Hope.
And they connect them.
If the Empire has this kind of power, what chance do we have?
What chance do we have? The question is, what choice? Run, hide, plead for mercy, scatter your forces. You give way to an enemy this evil with this much power, and you condemn the galaxy to an eternity of submission. The time to fight is now.
Now, the time to, and so they do.
And so they do. There's your Braveheart speech right there.
Yes.
You know,
there are a number of Braveheart speeches.
You gotta have at least one.
Right.
You know, I liked this film okay. I was not blown away by this. Personally, I feel like as a standalone film, there could have been a lot more room to do something different and something very new, very original. This reminded me a lot of the most recent Star Wars, where a lot of nostalgia, a lot of callbacks to the original film. You know, John, you've seen characters big and small from first film show up.
Indeed.
I won't spoil anything. The one character that I did like was Diego Luna as the rebel captain, Cassian, because he's more of like a resistance fighter. He does, you see him do at least one kind of morally questionable thing in this film. And that's kind of interesting and kind of edgy for a Star Wars film. So I did like that. But I think this is definitely for fans only. It's a stopgap between the two episodes, the next episode that's coming up. To me, I thought it was entertaining. It didn't really rivet me. It didn't really knock my socks off.
Do you think it could have something to do with the fact that the whole movie is based on the premise that we have to download the files? And so they're like climbing around on this stuff and having to put in a tape that looks like it's something from the 1980s,
very
like a
large
VCR tape.
Sort of 8-track.
Have they never heard of zip drives?
This was a long, long time ago.
Yeah.
The technology was older back then.
I know. Well, anyway, in the future, we won't have flash drives.
They didn't have thumb drives then.
No. But Felicity Jones as the rebel fighter Jyn in Rogue One Star Wars, that's the offering. Now, the other big offering this week, it seems, is the heartstring tugger. Why don't you tell us a little bit about Collateral Beauty?
Collateral Beauty, this is Will Smith, plays an advertising executive who has lost his daughter. He withdraws, becomes depressed. He starts writing letters to love, time, and death.
In the letter you wrote me, you said I was pathetic. You don't remember? Oh, Howard, it wasn't that long ago.
Where did you get that? Who are you?
Who did you write the letter to?
I wrote the letter to death.
Nice to meet you.
Well, that's provocative. Amazing cast.
Incredible cast. That's Helen Mirren, for one, who plays plays a person who is playing the role of death. Kate Winslet, Edward Norton, who's fantastic in this film. Keira Knightley. Yeah, so an amazing cast. Michael Peña as well. I wish they weren't sort of immersed in this hot tub of self-pity and false sentiment and tear-jerking that this movie is. It's one of these sort of Manhattan yuppie magic realism films where everything in the movie is designed to uplift the one central character and bring him out of his pain. And I just didn't buy it. I didn't buy the Shyamalan-style twist that comes. I didn't buy the whole storyline of the actors who are going to play these roles and somehow help him break through. I just thought it was, if it was not for that cast, I would find this film unwatchable.
So it's a ghost that doesn't work.
I think that's right.
Absolutely not. All right. The final film here is a pretty interesting offering here. It's Denzel Washington. Is this the movie Fences based on the August Wilson play?
Yes. Yes, it is. So Washington plays and directs, by the way. He plays Troy Maxson. He's a father, 1950s Pittsburgh. He used to be a promising baseball player, but he kind of arrived a little bit too early before they started admitting blacks to the league. And now he's a garbage man trying to provide for his family.
Hey, Pop. Can I ask you a question? How come you ain't never liked me?
Like you? What law is there say I got to like you?
None.
All right, then. Don't you eat every day? Answer me when I talk to you. Don't you eat every day?
Yeah.
As long as you're in my house, you put a sir on the end of it when you talk to me.
Yes, sir.
You eat every day.
Yes, sir.
Got a roof over your head.
Yes, sir.
Got clothes on your back.
Yes, sir.
Why you think that is?
Because of you.
Hell, I know it's because of me.
Boy, that's crisp.
I mean, you know, you can't beat Denzel Washington. And this is
and
a great
August Wilson.
And August Wilson. This is a great role. It's a great match in some ways. The acting in here is incredible. Viola Davis plays Denzel Washington's wife in this film. Down to the supporting roles in this film, everyone's great. I did feel a little bit like this film still felt like a play, even though it was shot on location in Pittsburgh.
Mm-hmm.
It still has that kind of three-wall feeling that limits it a little bit, but it is like a masterclass in acting. You just couldn't hope for better performances. I think you'll definitely see both Viola Davis and Denzel Washington come up in the Oscar nominations.
And the race dialogue holds up, particularly in this time.
I think it does. I think it does. I think it still feels relevant. These themes of the faded American dream. I do think these things kind of speak to people of all colors these days.
That's
so
right.
There is that to say about Fences.
Timeless August Wilson. Rafer Guzman, film critic for Newsday. Thanks so much.
Thanks, John.
The Takeaway is supported by American Express. American Express has cards and services designed for businesses of all sizes. Learn more at open.com. Exxon and Mobil, offering Synergy gasoline engineered in Exxon Mobil's Formula One fuel lab. Exxon and Mobil, energy lives here. The Henry Luce Foundation, for increased understanding of East and Southeast Asia. The Takeaway's resilience reporting is supported by the Rockefeller Foundation. For more, go to rockfound.org.
If you want to catch up on that conversation or listen back to anything on the program, check us out at thetakeaway.org. Thanks so much for listening. I'm John Hockenberry. Have a great weekend. This is The Takeaway.